The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Hello and welcome once again to Spin the Rally Pod, a bonus episode of Spin the Rally Pod. Normally we come into your little podcast provider on a Tuesday, but today is not a Tuesday, as I'm sure you're aware, if you're listening to this on the day it has come out. But with Safari Rally Kenya around the corner, that's just about as good an excuse as any to do something a little bit different. I am your host today, Luke Barry, and I am joined, I am delighted to say, actually already from Kenya, George Donaldson. George, how are you?
Good evening, Luke. I've never been better, and I'm back in Kenya, first full day in Kenya. Happy to say that everything is usual here in Kenya. All the people are friendly and lovely. The weather, of course, is we're in winter here for Kenya, or they're sort of winter. They don't really have a winter season on the equator, but it's the sort of winter, so it's cloudy. And only about 21, 22 degrees. So for some of our colleagues, namely David Evans, he would love it here at this time of year. There are showers and rain. There was none in Nairobi today, but I believe there was showers up at Lake Naivasha today. Very, very generally sort of wet, but no big rains. But thunderstorms threatened every day. So if they strike at the right or wrong time around enough of the route, we could actually end up having a bit of a wet safari. I would like it for every stage. But anyway, I'm happy to be here, and it's just gorgeous. Absolutely amazing.
We will indeed be doing a full preview episode for the Safari Rally this year in the coming days as well. So don't worry, we'll have plenty of information on this year's rally. I do have to say as well, just from my end, it's Thursday evening we're recording this. 22 degrees is actually what it is for me right now in Scotland, George. So I'm sure you're aware, you only flew away a couple of days ago, but you're missing some quite extraordinary weather for Scotland at this time of year. It's all very bizarre. No sign of rain here. All blue skies and sunshine, even at this time of night.
I am loving it. And of course, in summer in Scotland, it doesn't get dark until like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. Still, you could still read a newspaper sitting out in the garden at 11 o'clock at night the other night in my up a little bit further north than Luke. So a little bit more daylight, another few seconds of daylight every day, the further north you go. And here, where you come and it feels like summer, it gets dark. At 6:30 in the evening, it's perfectly light. And you think, well, it kind of looks like it's maybe getting towards the end of the day. And by 6:45, 15 minutes later, it's pitch black. So night falls very, very quickly here. And it's one of the unique and amazing things that's quite hard to get used to. It's a little bit easier this time of year because the sun isn't really out. It's behind the cloud. But it goes from perfectly light to perfectly dark in 15 minutes. That's always a bit of a shocker. I love it, though.
There you go. Yeah. But we know you do. I think there's lots of rallies on the calendar. Well, George loves any rally, as we all know. But I think Safari really does have a special place in your heart. And it's why we've got you on. We'd have you on anyway. But you are the perfect man to talk about some Safari stories from the past, given A, your affinity with the event, and B, just how many times you've been here. I'm going to put you on the spot with this question because you might not know. But 2023, you're obviously back again. It's your third in a row since Kenya's returns to the World Championship calendar. But do you actually know how many safaris you've done now? It must be.
I think this is 21. It's either 20 or 21 now.
Wow.
And let me think. 7, 8. So probably about 10, 11, 12. Let me think. 10 of them were full classics. And then up until 2003 was the last one, of course, that we did. And it was already getting quite a shortened route, although the sections were still big. They were still full on. So up until 1996, so I started in 86 to 95, they were all full-length safaris going right round the country, servicing wherever you wanted. And then in 96, it came service park areas. So you had basically service zones and service parks, basically one service park a day. And the rally still moved around the country, and it still went full length of a petrol tank on the car, a fuel tank on the car. But it became foreshortened at that point. And then now we've come back to this safari rally, which, honestly speaking, is in. If you look at it on a map, you think, what is that? It's nothing. But honestly speaking, when you go out and you drive the sections, somehow it still feels, I don't know how the organisers have managed it, how Kenya has managed it, but somehow you feel like you're doing a full big safari. It's amazing. And the longest section we have now is 30 kilometres. Back in the day, the shortest section would have been considerably longer than 30 kilometres. The shortest section might have been 70 or 80 k's. Again, the longest going up to 170, 180 k's with refuel in the middle. You stopped and refueled at times. You certainly had the option for refueling in the middle of stages if you felt you needed it. Tire change, emergency service. Open road rallying it was right up until 1996. Then it changed.
See, this just blows my mind. I'm sorry to cut across you, but this, obviously I'm for full disclosure, I'm 25 years old at the minute. So what's scary about that is George has been to almost as many safaris as I've been alive, which is mental. Yeah. But that means obviously I was born in 97. So I'm the same age as the World Rally Car, which is a nice little random pub quiz fact for anybody if I ever make it and become famous. But we've got, to me, just thinking about, and obviously I've read all the stories and you see archive footage, but just for me, and I'm sure there's so many fans listening to this that want to have the same experience as I want to sort of, and I'm lucky enough to talk to you directly about, but I just want to try and experience and take myself back to, and I don't want to use the phrase the good old days because that's dangerous, but the safaris of years gone by, because they were, and I know lots of rallying now compared to then isn't the same. We know that, so many reasons for it, but there's just something about the safari and the way it used to be, which is quite remarkable and incredible, and scarcely believable now if you compare to what a rally is to what you would get away with maybe in the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm looking at a map here from, I think it's 1991 or 92. I've got the whole map book, the whole Toyota map book from the whole rally. And here's the thing, six legs in the rally. Six legs. It wasn't 6 days because some of the legs ran at night. You know, they ran through the night. And sometimes, you know, they just stopped, the rally stopped for 4 hours, maybe 5 hours, and then continued again. And this rally ran from as far north as the, well, above the Cherangani Hills, above a place called Kapenguria in the north. That was on the northwest side. On the northeast side, it ran up as far as Maralal, the 1991 actually went further north. So I think this must be a 92 map. So it's a way above Mount Kenya, way north of Mount Kenya, up into the scrub desert, you know, not sand desert, but the scrub desert in the north of Kenya, basically out of that subtropical zone that we currently sit in. So you're coming out of all the trees and the beautiful lush greenery that we normally see in Kenya, up into that scrubland. So it went and all the way down to the coast, all the way down to Mombasa and up to, what's the name of the place? I can't remember the name of the sea, Malindi. Malindi was the seaside resort. It's not really a seaside resort. It's just a town, just short of Malindi, Kilifi, the old Kilifi Bridge and the Kilifi Ferry that you, if you go back into safaris in the 80s and 90s, the late 70s and mid up to late 80s, there was a ferry crossing and the rally cars used that ferry crossing. It only took 8 cars at a time. I can't imagine what it was like. There must have been a control either side of it. But
you'd hope so.
Yeah.
That could be so, chaos.
So six legs. And let me tell you how many controls there were on the rally, how many time controls. So like actual speed time controls, these are not just like check-in points. I think we were at 100 and, well, no, that's not true. I'm not sure. We had 105 service points. Wow. On the rally. So now we have one service point. So 105 service points. I mean, these are proper service points. You also had chase cars and you had helicopters with mechanics in them as well. So you had all sorts. Amazing, amazing, amazing stuff.
It's incredible. It blows my mind.
I should scan this map and we should put it onto the website. What do you think? It's a lot of pages. there are 20 pages or 20 or 30, 25 pages in it, I think there are, in the map book. It's massive.
I said this to George, and I think George is aware of it, but I think it's the classic scenario of whenever you're living something or you have something, you don't realise just what you've got. I am sure George's loft is a treasure. In fact, I'm not sure. I know it is. It's a treasure chest of rallying gold. There's so many things you have up there. And one day we need to take a visit, take the video camera and just look through everything that you've got.
My wife would welcome if you came to my house and took it away. Honestly, she hates it. She hates the fact I kept stuff. And I actually went up into the attic. I was in Dirtfish. I was in the northwest with them just at the end of May, and I took across a suitcase full of old rally clothing going back as far as 87, 88, all the way through the 90s and all the way through the early noughties. I had a massive amount of team clothing, and I gave it all I gave about 30 different garments to the guys there. To hopefully, it was to be distributed amongst all the team that's there. But I somehow, when I left there, it was still all sitting in Nate's office. Don't think he'd given any of it. His office is lying open for any of the Dirtfish crew that are not aware it's there. I'm sure you can go and filch whatever you want. It's there to be filched, guys. Anyway.
Yeah, we've rumbled Nate. If he has been trying to hide that and hoard it for himself, sorry, Nate. We've rumbled you.
He was sharing it with everyone. Nate's such a lovely guy. He would never do such a thing.
He would never do such a thing.
Yeah.
Anyway. Now, George, obviously at the minute, you're coming to Safari this year, helping Colin Clark and our cameraman Elliot Barnard with our coverage of the event, which of course will be available via Dirtfish Live Centre next week. But when you first came here, and I think you just said it, and correct me if I'm wrong with this, but 1986, working for Toyota. Give us an insight into what that was like, coming to your first Safari and how that experience was.
Well, it was remarkable. I got a phone call. Well, I got invited to come in November the year before, and could I come for the recce and help with the recce and the test and the build-up? This was Group B, the Group B Toyota Celica, twin cam turbo, rear wheel drive. And they'd won Safari Rally in 1984 and 1985. So they were going to go for the hat trick on this occasion. And I actually flew directly from the end of Swedish Rally. It was my second flyaway event for Toyota. I'd done Ivory Coast the year before. And because I'd not screwed up and I'd done everything I was meant to do and said yes to doing everything, they'd let me come to Kenya, which was like such an amazing treat. It's an event I wanted to come to since I first discovered what rallying was. And I think I was born wanting to come to this rally, I'll be honest with you, because it seemed to be the biggest and most amazing adventure. And of course, when I arrived, I came down with two Swedish mechanics that had been around for years and had been coming out with, even before, I think, Toyota in the case of one of them. And they were telling me great stories about the event. And I felt then like you feel now. I'm listening to the great stories of these old events, you know. But actually, I was in for a treat because actually the rally hadn't changed at all in the previous 25 years. It was, okay, it used to go into Tanzania and Uganda, but that's just more of the same. No disrespect to those countries, but you know, it's just the same type of rallying. It's brilliant. Absolutely amazing. So, we were still doing, you know, six legs. We were doing a five-day event. And you might have seen bed once or twice for a few hours in those 5 days. I mean, that was just brilliant. So I flew down. So we, as I recall, we flew out of Stockholm down to into Switzerland. So that would have been Zurich or where I think it was Zurich we flew into. Suspect it was, and we're meant to connect with a Swiss Air flight down to Kenya, but the flight was delayed. Technical, we were on the airplane taxiing out when it got bumped back, and we had to spend the night in Switzerland. So that's when I sat in the bar with them for a few hours, more than a few hours probably, on I think a Monday evening. It was a Monday evening because it was the day after the Swedish rally that we... No, that's not quite right. No, because I drove straight from the finish to the airport. I had to actually have my suitcases all packed. No, so it must have been a Sunday night. And then we sat in the...
That's incredible.
We sat in the bar. It was amazing. My service crew had to drive like the wind to catch the flight. So that British service crew in a British registered car driving from Karlstad to Stockholm pretty well as fast as we could. And we got there. We got there in time. And I got the flight, met the two Swedes, hard as nails, the pair of them, but they were great. And they told me stories to turn your hair white in the bar, in the hotel in Zurich. And then we flew the next day down to Kenya and just had the most amazing time. I was down here, I think, for, at that point, I think I was down here for 8 weeks, 8 or 9 weeks before the rally.
Well, that's the key thing I wanted to touch on, because you said this to me in sort of private conversations about how long and how many months a year you would spend in Kenya, because it wasn't like now where you can't do any testing on location. Here you could do as much testing as you wanted, and it made complete sense, obviously, to test your car in the places that would be competing. So you were part of the team that would essentially go through all of that testing before the arduous rally got underway.
Yeah, it was just exactly like it sounds. It was absolutely amazing. So it's a free for all. Everybody expects to see rally cars in Kenya between November and Easter the next year. There would be rally teams there testing Lancia, Toyota, Ford as well at that point. So it was quite common, but Toyota were one of the big players. Toyota had been rallying with Uwe Andersson since 1973, was it 72 or 73, I think 72 maybe. RAC Rally was one of Uwe Andersson's first events, and then he got a contract with Toyota and persuaded them to invest more and allow him to build a team with them. And then, you know, it built slowly over the years. They got a victory very early on the Thousand Lakes with a Corolla, actually, and Hannu Mikkola. And I think that might have been the 1974 Thousand Lakes Rally.
EWRC would have it.
We won't look at it as we talk, but I'm sure our listeners can check that
Somebody
out.
Somebody can correct us, yes.
It might even have been 75, but it certainly wasn't 76. But it was one of those early to mid-70s Thousand Lakes rallies. Hannu Mikkola won, and what an amazing character he was. Privilege of meeting him more than once or twice. But he won Thousand Lakes. Again, that just gave Toyota the lift. And then, you know, I guess they had limited budgets and, you know, the way they homologated cars. Anyway, so the team was, of course, always looking for events they could do well on. And Toyota were keen on the African market. And Uwe said we could concentrate on that. So we did. And then through the late 70s and early 80s, the team started to build up experience, Ivory Coast. And it was just, I don't think they came to Kenya for a couple of years. I can't quite remember. Again, we'd have to look back on our EWRC for that. But the Ivory Coast was where the car really got built. And I mean, initially they'd built a good, tough car, went to Ivory Coast, car fell apart. So they went back again and it fell apart again. And then they went testing and it fell apart. And finally they started to build up a tough car. And then they got to homologate and they got some results. And the Japanese manufacturer, the guys back in Japan, decided to invest more. So they built the Group B car, and they built the Group B car for Africa. Now, this car came out after the Audi Quattro had come out, and the Audi Quattro was, of course, winning everything in the early 80s. I think the twin cam turbo, I think its first events were in 83. I believe it was 83. And then 84 Safari Rally was its first Safari Rally, 1984. And it came out and it won first time out. And that win, oddly enough, so first time there, but the team had been building up over the years and it had respect. And it was Nini Russo. I remember seeing a video of that, like one of Barry Hinchcliffe's famous films of Safari Rally, 1984. And Nini Russo at Lancia is being interviewed, and he said, "Who do you think the big threat is? You know, is it Hannu in the Quattro, or whoever else it was? I can't remember all the names. Ari Vatanen was of course there, and whatever he was driving." And Nini said, "I think Bjorn in the Toyota is the biggest threat." And of course, they would have known that car was built in Safari spec. It could do 140 miles an hour and it would pull 140 miles an hour in fifth gear up a hill on gravel. It was so fast. So we had high speed. And this is a high speed event. It was a high speed event. It was amazing. So Toyota built a car strong, very simple, very tough, massively reliable, simple car with massive top speed. And we blew everyone away. And you've got to remember that car also won New Zealand rally against four-wheel drives and Lancias, Lancia 037s. And that very, very simple, you know, for want of a better word, a rather big and heavy Mark II Escort is what it was, turbocharged, was the car that so it did have other victories. But basically, they focused on Kenya. And, you know, Toyota chose to, you know, they have their reputation for toughness and reliability, which they still have. They still trade on that, and that's why winning in Safari was so important for the manufacturer. It was a massive deal, and became a massive deal because we did so well. Yeah, and I was a small part of that. Of course,
well as you mentioned. Sorry, George.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, as you mentioned, that 1984 debut was Bjorn did in fact win the rally. 85, yep. It was Juha Kanker, and 86, the year you were there, it was a second 1-2 in a row as well, not just a win, but a 1-2. Bjørn Voldegard and Lars-Erik Torf, 1-2. So if you can, and I know I'm stretching on memories from quite a few years ago, it's sad to say, but what was the atmosphere like in that team when you joined after having won the last two events? Was there this sort of expectation? I don't want to use the word pressure, but just this expectation that Toyota would deliver another victory in Safari?
No, I can't say that I recall that at all. I mean, Bjorn was an almost unbelievably diligent tester. You know, like, I mean, he would go out and he wanted to test everything. And I remember, now Pirelli, the Pirelli guys will not thank me for this memory, but it's actually quite a positive story about Pirelli. Just before the rally, so I'd been here about, you know, by that time 6 weeks, and we'd got a new batch of tyres had arrived, I think I drove back. So we were testing down at Taita Hills, which is about 300 kilometres south of Nairobi, and we were testing in the Taita Hills area and around the Rukanga Loop to the south of Taita Hills, which is a really rough little loop. It's hard, it's tough. And sorry, if you can hear the rustling of papers, it's me looking through the maps here to catch all the names of all the fabulous places. Yeah, so
that's
we're down
fantastic.
At Taita Hills, Voi, and that loop, that Rukanga loop, quite a short section. That would have been one of the, you know, 50 or 60 kilometre loops, but a rough little section. And then it went straight. It didn't actually stop at that section. It then went across the road and went up into the Taita Hills and ran through the Taita Hills, which was really tight and technical. And then it would finish up towards the place called Maktaw. And then you had a short road section about 40 kilometres, and it was a gravel road, very, very fast gravel road, out to a place called Taveta, and then you went into another section north, up around the top of Kilimanjaro, and into Amboseli, and you'd maybe get a small... Anyway, sorry, I digressed. We were testing in that area, that's the bottom line. And there was a new rally tyres. This is about 8 days before the rally, 9 days before the rally. The batch of rally tyres had been shipped down. They came air freight for Pirelli. And I was sent up to Nairobi there was only a small group of people there. One guy in Nairobi looking after the workshop, a job that later became mine, and a very small test team. I think at that time we were only three mechanics. It was the two Swedes and myself had been there all that time. And some engine engineers came in and out, but that was about it. And the main engineer we had, the vent engineer, was a guy called Gert Pfeiffer Pepper. He would of course have been there by this point for this latter stage of testing. Anyway, I went up, got the tyres, all the way up to Nairobi, got the tyres, and I think I drove up at night. Never a smart thing to do, but I was happy enough to do it. Got the tyres and then drove down the next morning, so I probably didn't sleep much. got the tyres, and I think I just had two sets mounted. So I had eight tyres in the back of this van. It was just a high-ace van. Put the tyres on the car, went out and tested them. And so I think I remember we were sitting at Voy Lodge, Voy Petrol Station. There's a road runs west towards Tanzania, the main road into Tanzania at that time, through a place called Taveta, already mentioned it. And you ran south, and the road south down to this Rukanga loop, which was quite a rough bit of road. That's where Bjorn wanted to test these tyres. He felt he could get quite a few runs of everything. Drove down the road to a place called Mwangu, and noticed the vibration in the car, got out and inspected the tyres, and drove back up the road. Now, I hasten to add, he would have been driving up the road at... He would do those roads at rally speeds. You always did it at rally speeds. You were allowed to. There was no speed limit for rally cars. It was suspended for rally cars in Kenya. That law is probably still on the statutes, but it was only for Safari Rally, and it was only during the time that the teams were there. And he drove back up the road. And bearing in mind that car would happily sit at 245 kph. That was its top speed, which it could pull on gravel up a hill. As I said, it could have even used a longer gear. Came back up the road, and by the time he got back to us, the tyres were falling apart. It was like the rubber had turned to mush. And so we fitted another set of tyres, and exactly the same happened to them. We only had two sets, so we destroyed them both. So it was a big discussion. We went into the Void Lodge. It was very, very hard to phone anywhere at that time, and it was very hard to get a line out of Kenya, but we phoned. I think it was Fred Gallagher that finally got on the phone, or maybe it was Gert Pfeiffer. Big discussion, as much as you could have a big discussion on the phones, because you never keep a connection for very long at that time. Anyway, it turned out, George, can you just take those tyres back up to Nairobi, get them taken off the rims and take them out to the airport? They're going back to Pirelli. They want to see what's happened to them. So we sent them back. And I drove up. So that was, this was at lunchtime on the day. So I'd driven up and down to Nairobi. I drove back up to Nairobi before lunchtime. I'd driven back up to Nairobi. So I'd got in it's about a 3.5 hour drive. Got back in, got the tyres off the rim. The guys were ready to get them off the rims. Got them out to the airport, and they were shipped back. Next morning, Pirelli have got those tyres. 24 hours after we've received them, they're back in Italy, and they're wanting to know what they were like. Oh, and the other instruction I was told to take them to the air freight terminal and make sure they went on the flight. And the air freight guys, I remember them saying, "No, we can't guarantee it." I said, "They've got to go." I said, "Could I take them as luggage if I buy a ticket?" Yes, you could. But let's try the freight. So I was just about on a flight on my way to Italy to take those, because it was so important to get them back. Bjorn insisted that these went back to Pirelli because he thought there was something dreadfully wrong. He could feel that the construction wasn't right. And all he'd driven down a very fast tarmac road, he could tell that they weren't right. And he went back to Pirelli. Pirelli opened up the tyres. It turns out that one of the layers, and there are many construction layers in tyres, as everybody knows. I mean, there are literally dozens and dozens of layers. And Pirelli tyres at that time, as they are now, are very, very sophisticated tyres. They're some of the most sophisticated tyres in the world, if not right up there at the front. And it turns out that the guy that had, if you imagine that the building these bespoke tyres, it's like an architect's drawing, the way that they're constructed. And it turns out the engineers that had been, or the construction engineers that had been laying up all the tyres, had made a mistake, and they had put some of the layers in the wrong order. And that's what had happened with these tyres. So we had 600 tyres delivered to Nairobi that previous day, and they all had to be replaced, and the rally was in 10 days' time. And Pirelli got all the tyres made again, and shipped down by air again, all of them.
Wow.
All of them, yeah.
That's some effort. 600 tyres.
Very, very impressive. Because, you know, there would be absolutely... This is not machine construction. It's bespoke construction, I guess. Anyway, they got us a whole new set of tyres down, and that was beyond the detail. And then we got the tyres. You know, we got the first batch of those tyres about 7 or 8 days later, and the recce was pretty well. They were into the last little pass of the recce, and again, I was still on the recce at that point. And somebody came out with the tyres, and then and I think we had about 3 or 4 sets at this point. And Bjorn, you know, I think we literally ran round Mount Kenya twice on those tyres, on that route. I mean, we just beat the hell out of them to make sure they were perfect. And that was Bjorn. You know, he didn't look for a test driver. He didn't want anyone else to do it. He would do it. Thanks very much. That was it. End of. The guy was just solid gold. Just the most amazing character and the most diligent of all test drivers. And worked himself very, very hard. His internal car equipment, I can remember that so clearly. About 2 days before the rally, Bjorn and they had finished the recce by this point, and they were doing PR duties, and there was pre-start stuff to do. There was pre-start cocktail evenings, and we even in a lowly mechanic such as myself got invited to these things. It was wonderful, and Bjorn would be at these things, but then when he wasn't there, he was in the workshop, and you know you carried equipment in case it was wet. And you had it prepared for your car. Sometimes you took it out, but you generally ran with it in the car. And Bjorn would, you know, you'd have 30 meter sections of steel rope and a high speed winch for pulling yourself out of a ditch if you got stuck. And you had all sorts of straps and shackles. And Bjorn used to sort it all out himself, clean it all up, oil it, paint it, lube it, whatever. And he wound everything up himself, tied it off himself with tie wraps. Made sure his own tie wraps were there, and he would put a spare set of tie wraps. He would put that in his tool bag or strap it with a bit of tape that doubled over so he could get it off quickly, but it wouldn't fall out in an accident, so that he knew he could get it quickly if he needed it, just because he knew it. And just that level of diligence and detail that Bjorn Waldegard exercised is why he won, why Toyota won so many safari rallies. Just amazing, absolutely amazing character, and an amazing discipline, and an amazing talent. I mean, his driving talent, I mean, despite all his diligence, he was probably the first Sebastian, if you know what I mean. You know, we've had two fantastic Sebastians through the noughties. Well, Bjorn Waldegard was absolutely a Sebastian. You know, in fact, the Sebastians were Bjorns. I think that's what we should call them now. So it's Bjorn Loeb and Bjorn Ogier, because you know we should do it in the right order, because he was so diligent around Safari Rally, and we tested and tested and tested, and he practiced and practiced. And when he changed to his co-driver Fred, and the first year for that was 1986, when my first year on Safari, Bjorn enjoyed writing the English pace notes so much. He thought this was great. It was for him. There was more descriptions and more possibilities with his notes. So this was a man in the latter years of his career at this point, you know, probably the last 4 or 5 years of his realistic career. And he changed the language of his pace notes. And because he liked doing it so much, they made pace notes for the entire route, including all the road sections. Because, as I said, the faster you went on the road section, and bearing in mind this was a road race, there was no speed limits, and everyone knew the rally was there, and the cars ran these wing lights, two wing lights that were always on. People saw them coming. Everyone moved out of the way. It was very diligent. It couldn't be done now, but the population of Kenya has tripled since the mid to late 80s and early 90s. It has tripled. A lot more traffic on the road. But at that time, it was viable. And the faster you went on the road section, the faster you could go on the road section safely, the more service time you got. Obviously, if you were knocking 9 bells out of your car, that wasn't a smart thing to do. But if the car could do it, then you basically that's where your service time was. And the organisers liaised with the teams when they were out, saying, you know, that road section, is that enough time to service? Of course, they were asking Toyota, and because Toyota had the fastest car, we were saying, no, that road section could be 2 or 3 minutes shorter, knowing that we could go a bit faster than everyone else. We were robbing them of service time. Yeah. So you play every advantage you can, don't you? But all the teams did that, you know, and then Nini Russo was undoubtedly going in and arguing with the organisers that, no, that needs to be longer, that needs to be longer. And of course, the organisers were always, at that time, the organisers were competing against the competitors. That's part of the competition, was the organisers were trying to beat the competitors, really, and make it as tough for them as they could so they couldn't manage it. So they were even making road sections shorter than we could manage to limit the service. I'm just looking at so there was 144 time controls on that rally that I'm looking at on this map. 144. Yeah, so many sections. I mean, 144 time sections on the rally. I mean, it was 3,000 kilometres, I think it was, at that time, the event.
That is just crazy. I was about to apologise for being quiet on this podcast, because I'll be honest with you listeners. I'm sitting here... I'm sitting here just soaking all of this in. But to be honest, I've got nothing to apologise for, because these stories are wonderful. We want to hear from George. What I've got next, and I'll be honest, this is quite a cliche question for a journalist to ask, so I'm going to apologise in advance, George, but you've obviously won and been around the world in all sorts of roles with rallying. You've won pretty much all of the rallies there are to win around the world in some capacity. But what does a win in Kenya mean compared to the rest, particularly in this era when you'd put... literally months of effort into trying to get that result?
Yeah, it was absolutely, I mean, and I never went to Japan in that era when we were winning. I was far lower down in the team structure at that point, but you know, we always had a large number of manufacturer visits, people coming from Japan to the event. There was a huge amount of weight and kudos in Japan for winning Safari Rally. And I think worldwide as well, in the WRC, different events had different weights, much as they are now. You know, winning Thousand Lakes Rally has always been a massively big deal. Yeah, definitely bigger than winning in a lot of other events. You know, winning in Monte Carlo is a massive deal. Again, you know, bigger than a lot of other events. But winning in Safari, that was another level again. It was, you know, it should have been double points for Safari Rally. And you know what? I think the world of rally, you know, everyone's talking about the thing needing a shake-up. Okay, double points for Safari Rally. How does that sound? And I know it's only the same length as everything else, but my God, it definitely has its challenges. I've been learning, sadly, I've sadly learned today that the rain that is on all the forecasts and that we're reading is, although it's what we would call very wet in Scotland, the landscape here just soaks it up. You've got to remember, we're a mile above sea level at this point, and there's a lot of places where there's no rock, it's just earth. It's a mile of earth. It's got an infinite capacity to soak up moisture. Very heavy rain, of course, like anywhere else, does flood, but it actually dries up in a day. And maybe 2 days maximum, it's all gone and the road's back to usual. So the rain we're having at the moment is not going to make a proper wet Safari Rally. However, mixed into that are thunderstorms. And that's what we've seen the last 2 years. We've had thunderstorms during the rally, both times over the unbelievably fabulous Sleeping Warrior stage up at just on the south side of Lake Elementaita, and it's a wonderful stage. I think it's pretty well on the 30 kilometres. It's one of the biggest stages on the rally again. Well, hopefully we'll see the rain a little bit more widespread generally, and it generally might just be a bit damper. So I'm sure if this was a wet Safari Rally, if this turned into a wet Safari Rally this year, I genuinely believe that Carl Tundo or Oliver Solberg could win. And I've just
in the rally two cars, yeah.
In the rally, I believe the rally two cars could win, because a wet Safari, a proper wet Safari, it becomes very slippery and very difficult. And honestly, you know, having 100 horsepower more, having 1.5 times the horsepower, is not going to help you here, even on the fast places, because 1.5 times nothing is still nothing. There's no traction. So, honestly speaking, those are the rally two cars, R5 cars, as I like to call them. They are very, very drivable. They are very strong. And they're being driven by some quite smart drivers out there, let's be honest. I mean, we've got a Polish driver again this year, that was here last year, that won Rally 2 last year.
Kaito Kajtanovic.
Kaito Kajtanovic. He's here. And obviously Oliver Solberg, who actually had a very, very tough time here last year. It looked like he did really badly. Believe me, he did not do really badly. He had a fantastically brilliant character-building event. Now, that
he
might
did.
Sound,
I agree.
That might sound a little bit derogatory to him, and it's far from it. And he would understand that it's not. Basically, everything crap that could happen happened to him. Everything that could go wrong with the car went wrong for him. If he approaches this rally in the right way and the conditions are right, he would be one of my favourites to win. I think in the normal course of things, Carl Tundo is also, you know, he used to live on these, he lived in Lake Naivasha for years. He will know all the, and the area's been rallied extensively. Carl Tundo will know those roads like the back of his hand. But the roads here are not like European roads, where the road is established over centuries with a road bed and rock carved out of the hill that just expands a little bit. The roads here change remarkably. So his local knowledge of the actual road is not worth much. His understanding of the event and how it goes is huge. So if I was Oliver Solberg, in fact, if I was any WRC driver coming to this event, I would be getting a hold of Carl Tundo, who's a current driver, or Ian Duncan.
Duncan.
And
yeah.
I would be buying those guys dinner, and I would be bending their ear for every insight they could. And you know who would do that? Bjørn Waldegard would have done that. You know, not that he needed to, but you know, that's the sort of detail we want to go. You'd want to mine every little bit of information out of this so you can understand it. And Oliver Solberg, I know he's diligent and I know he thinks about things. At least I really hope I know him well enough to know that he'd do that, because if he sits down, lines up everything that happened to him, all the little causes, all the reasons, all the things he could have done had he realised that was about to happen to mitigate that event. If you stack them up, get them in order in your brain, if your brain's all stacked up, loaded like a magazine of actions and details and things to avoid and not do, and yes, do and not do, times to do it, times not. If you've got yourself preloaded with that going into a difficult, wet, tricky, slippery safari rally, you will sail through the event. And I can say that with certainty because I watched Bjørn Waldegard do it twice. Just amazing. Yeah.
That is a tantalising thought to think about the prospect of a Rally 2 car upsetting the Rally 1s. And there will be, of course, more discussion about this year's event in the preview episode, which will be out in the coming days. But George, just to look a little bit sort of backwards, but also more... Yes. No, you're all good. Also more globally, I guess. I was doing a little bit of research, mm-hmm. which I'll be honest, our front up is a little bit rare for me. I tend to try and rely on my anorak brain, but I thought, I want to get this right this time. And I was counting the amount of successes that Toyota has had on this event in the past, and I believe this year, if they were to win, it would be a 10th Safari success, and no other manufacturers anywhere near close to that. George, you've been involved in, I think, over half of those victories, so maybe we're asking somebody that's a biased source, I'm not sure, but to put you on the spot, why do you think Toyota has been so successful here? Because even there's so many, you mentioned obviously a lot about 86, you were there winning a lot with the Celica GT4 in the 90s, obviously in the last couple of years with the Yaris as well last year with the 1, 2, 3, 4. So for some reason, it's always been an event that Toyota has succeeded on.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can say that in the 80s and 90s when we did very well, it was down to a very diligent and focused approach. Even when Toyota Team Europe at that time became a fully fledged world championship team, which only really happened when they got the four-wheel drive Celica. That's when they started to enter the full championship. Up until then, they just did bit parts. They never did a full championship. They would do 7 or 8 rallies a year tops, and not all of them necessarily WRC. I remember they came and did the Scottish rally in 1986. Believe it or not, with the Group B Celica, they came with Lars Erik Torp and Bjørn Waldegard. So that would probably be the next event after Safari Rally. They came to Scotland to do the Scottish Rally because they had to do X number of rallies for in their contract, and they came and did the Scottish Rally. How amazing was that for me? I just started sort of full time with the team as a freelancer, I know that sounds like a misnomer, but it wasn't. And they came and did the Scottish Rally. It was fantastic. One of the fun things we did on that rally actually was worked out that the team manager, Henry Lydon at the time, could actually go from service point to service point by train. around, he could do at least two legs by train. When it ran around the northeast of Scotland, there was enough railway stations. The timetable wasn't good, but it was fun working out when we did all the map marking. In those days, you did map marking manually, and everybody got a full set of Ordnance Survey maps for the whole rally, all marked up manually. It was an amazing... That's another story, isn't it? Sorry. So we digressed away there. Why did they do so well in Safari Rally? Hard work and focus. It was obviously important to do well to advance the team. And the team had a limited resource, so they focused on Safari Rally. And through the 90s, when they became that fully-fledged team, they didn't lose that focus because the value of winning Safari Rally was now embedded into the psychology of the manufacturer. It's Safari Rally, Toyota must be there, Toyota must be in the pack, in the lead. I know that, obviously, there's always commercial pressure on teams to succeed and push and do well, but I never ever saw that all the senior presidents in Toyota that came to the rallies. It was never full presidents like we're seeing now with Akio Toyoda, but they came and when you spoke to them, as they did, they would come and speak to all the team members. They were very, very personable, the guys that came and presided over the team. They had a very sanguine approach to the whole thing, very realistic. We know this is a sport. We know it's tough, but it's great that we're here and we're pushing and leading at the front. Anything can happen. You know, you can hit some wildlife with a car. You'd be leading the rally by 10 minutes and catch an impala, or just, you know, catch a ditch that wasn't there during the recce. There's been a little bit of rain through, or somebody's been working on the road. There's a ditch there. Nobody puts cones out or markers out for it. And you just rattle the car over that and it's done. So they understood that. They were realistic about it. But they always wanted us to do well in Safari. So the reason that we did well through the early and mid-90s was absolutely purely because we worked hard at it. And, you know, at that time, so we were very dominant in the mid-80s. Then through the late part of the 80s, we were very good, but we didn't win anything. We didn't win 87, 88 or 89. That was with the Supra. So the first year was normally aspirated Supra. The 88 was the turbocharged Supra, and 89 was the turbocharged Supra. And then in 1990, we came with the four-wheel drive Celica, which had been very, very fragile feeling car and very, very difficult to get it all organised and right. And, you know, we're struggling to make it fast and trying to get it X, Y, and Z. And, you know, the car had, the focus on the car was to get it quick. That was the whole focus of that car, was to be fast and take on Lancia with their already established Delta. We started that car in the middle of 1988. So we never took that to Kenya for 2 years, basically, because we felt it was too fragile. But we brought it out. Bjorn did a huge amount of testing. He wasn't doing the full series that year. He did all the testing. He forged that car and developed it here in Kenya in that same fashion that he had in 1986 when I first went with the Group B car with them. And lo and behold, we won that rally. We didn't win in 91. Lancia won 91, but I think we won again in 92, 93, 94 and 95. Yeah. So... those were good years, but we were up against good teams. I mean, it wasn't just a washover. We had to work hard at it every year, every time. You know, we had a pretty serious challenge, we felt, from Ford in, I'm not sure what year it was, but for some reason, when they came to the event, they came with a superb Ford Sierra Cosworth. And I think it was four-wheel drive Ford Sierra Cosworth. We felt it was the car to do this. They had Stig Blomqvist was the prime driver. I think they only came with two cars. But they prepared all the cars down in Mombasa for some reason, because that's what they used to do back in the 70s. And then they had their mechanics drive the car. Two of the senior engineers drove the cars up the road from Mombasa to Nairobi. And one of them got written off. I don't know whether they drove at night or whether it was during the day, but one of the drivers wrote Stig's car off. He ended up having to use an adapted recce car, which is already very tired. Recce test car, and the car fell apart during the rally. But again, it was a serious challenge. They just made a mistake. They did something silly. It was just 500 kilometres to drive from Mombasa to Nairobi. That was just a two-lane highway, and very often half of one lane was gone with a huge pothole. You couldn't drive up that road anything except carefully. There was years you could drive it. You could drive it flat out in a high-ace van, and then the next year the road was gone and it was just potholes. The difference in time, you could do Nairobi to Mombasa on a good year, you could do it in about 4.5 to 5 hours in a van. On a bad year, it would take you 10 to 12 hours to do it. Exactly the same road.
Wow.
It wasn't traffic, it was just the condition of the road. It would change so vastly. Yeah. Wet or dry.
That's incredible.
Depended. Yeah, massive. So I think they won just because of absolute hard work, focus, and it was important to us. So, you know, and I know everyone said, oh, Toyota threw money at it, but actually it wasn't expensive because you just had 5 or 6 guys in Nairobi. We had a workshop that was gifted to us by the importer. You know, or maybe we rented it. It wasn't a lot of money. I mean, we had that same workshop for many years, all the years I was involved as a coordinator and a workshop manager here in Nairobi, and then finally as team manager. We kept that workshop all the way through until the end. We kept vehicles here. It wasn't expensive to compete. It wasn't. And we did all the testing with Avgas from the airport. You know, it was cheap. It was cheap in those days. That was before you were spending whatever it is, 10 euros a litre on fuel.
Yeah.
You know, it was just Avgas, which was tax-free. You know, it's aviation fuel. Here in Kenya at that time, it was tax-free. I think I was buying a 200-litre drum of what's it called? 100 LL Avgas. You also get 105 LL here in Kenya at that time. I can't remember what I was paying a drum, but it was cheaper than pump fuel at that time.
Wow. Yeah, you see, yeah. I'm quite glad you can't remember how much it cost, because that would just make us realize how much inflation is hitting the world.
Yeah, it was relatively cheap anyway. So, you know, testing wasn't expensive. And, you know, we didn't run helicopters during the tests in the 80s. During the 90s, we did start to use helicopters on some of the test areas just as a safety tool because we were spending so long here. But again, it was local helicopters. They're not as expensive as you think. And you're not doing that. You know, you'd have it for a whole day, but you'd only actually fly off 3 hours in a day. And it allows you to test at full speed. Well, compared to the cost of a test road in Europe, it's actually cheap.
Were you ever in those helicopters? I assume you must have.
Yeah, I did. There was one of the high-speed tests I did. So that we used to do a high-speed test before Christmas. This was in the early-ish 90s. And I remember on one high-speed test, I did the helicopter all the way. And I think that was with Carlos. Did the high-speed test before Christmas. I think it was Carlos. Maybe it wasn't a high-speed test. It was a second high-speed test that we did one in February as well, because the first high-speed test hadn't been so good. So I think it was Carlos. I remember doing a heck of a lot of it. I don't know if I did all of it or just most of it, but basically the whole route at rally speed, but over the course of a week. And you pick your time. You always try and do it exactly the same time as the rally, and you would pull the sections out and slot them together and do it that way. So you weren't doing the whole thing on full rally timetable, but you did the sections at full rally timetable. So I did that with Carlos.
Well, to close this out, George, because again, I'm looking at our timer, and somehow we've managed to kill almost an hour of time
talking 10 minutes. We've not even touched on the event yet.
You never know. And this is what's terrifying. But the question I want to ask you, and I'll be honest, potentially it's an awful question, because I could probably predict the answer you're going to give me. But you've been to this rally, as you said, for over 20 times. You've done it in various different roles, from, as you say, starting as a mechanic to your sporting manager role, now to helping us cover it as media. But you've never driven the rally, George. Now, I don't know if you still harbour plans to be a rally driver, but how much would you have loved to try at this rally?
Massively, massively, massively. I did get to drive the entire route once about 1.5 times around the route, the whole route. I did the whole route once properly, and then and we did some other sections twice. You know, maybe we did another half a dozen sections twice, maybe not quite half the rally again. So that was on a photo shoot, a pre-Christmas photo shoot that the media team at Toyota wanted to do, and I got a phone call. It was Uwe Andersson's wife, Marion Bell Andersson. She wanted to do this photo shoot specifically to capture two rally cars together. But it was just prior to Christmas, and everybody else had gone home. Obviously, we had Ian Duncan.
I already know the picture. I know the picture you're talking about now. But do continue. My mind started working there.
So basically, we drove the entire route, being followed by a helicopter, as a two car team. We had Reinhard Klein there photographing, sometimes in the helicopter, sometimes on the ground. Sometimes we were going backwards and forwards down sections of the route. Sometimes we looped off the route because we'd spotted, the guys in the helicopter had spotted a nice bit of road that would make a better photograph. We found water at one point. There's a very famous poster photograph of two Celica GT4s, the ST185s, together on separate roads on a muddy section. That is at a place called, that was on the Kidong Valley, would you believe? The backside of Suswa, coming up to what is now the new railway station below Kajabi on the escarpment. I know exactly where it is, where that photograph was done, because I was driving the second car and I drove the entire route. Many of the sections were driven relatively competitively, and I got to just follow Ian, but I was obviously following 1 or 2 kilometres behind just to let the dust die down. No pace notes. My co-driver was alternately a sound guy who was a guy called Bernd, and I can't remember his last name. He was a German sound engineer. And when it wasn't him, it was Marion Bell Andersson, Uwe Andersson's wife. She sat in the car with me, and she did more than half the route with me, including we had one massive, massive moment on the main road going up towards Nakuru after Naivasha. And it's the bit of road that we still drive on Safari Rally between Naivasha and Nakuru. And it's just before a place called Gilgil. And I was following Ian, and I was only maybe a kilometre behind him. Ian went past a line of cars coming the other way. And after he passed, I was ready, thinking it might happen. But we were doing about 220 kph. A Matatu, or a pickup, pulled out from behind a truck. Saw me coming because I had the lights on, the wing lights on. Tried to pull back in and got a tank slapper on. And I had no idea where this guy could have gone off the road, and there was a bit of a drop down off the road, so he didn't want to go there. He was trying to avoid it. And it was the old railway bridge. It's just south of the old railway bridge, so it's a very easy place to identify. It's embellished in my brain. And I watched this guy doing his tank slappers, and I thought, well, I can brake and go off the road and we'll survive. And I was on the brakes, hit the brakes. And just after I hit the brakes, I realised we were getting very close to him at this point. I could cut off the road. But there was a risk that the guy was going to go that way. But I realised he'd just actually started to work his way across towards the ditch. So I went in between him and the truck. And I went through that gap about, 180 to 200 kph. And, it was quite cool about it. Braked, the car drifted a little bit, obviously, and sideways. But I came off the brakes and just steered for the gap that you could see was going to be there. The timing just set itself, and I went through the gap. Marion thought that was wonderful. I said, Marion, sorry about that. She said, George, I can't believe that you avoided it. And I said, I've still got the... At that point, I hadn't driven a rally car for a couple of years, but the instincts were still good. I think you'll know yourself about rally driver instinct. I think they stay with you forever. And anyway, I used them on that occasion. But driving the route, we drove the most incredible sections. We drove down the Kerio Valley, which I still recall as one of my favourite experiences. Coming out of Eldoret, we'd stopped the night in Eldoret, and we had to drive down towards a place called, Nieru, and you then drop down into the Kerio Valley, down past the big fluor spar mines where they used to get the stuff that goes in fluorescent lights. There's big settlement ponds and an airfield down there. and we drove that whole section, and then they realized that they'd seen the helicopter had spotted a great runway. So we drove back up the road section about another 60 k's back up to the start of the section, drove down it again onto this gravel runway, airport runway, that had this massive gorgeous, rather narrow Kerio Valley, but it's about half a mile deep. It's a huge gouge in the earth. The top of the valley is about 8,000 feet, and the bottom is about, you know, 6,000 feet, something like that. A long way down, and you just drop down through it. I always remember that, driving that section with Ian, because when I got to the end, he couldn't believe that I turned up just 2 minutes after him. And he said, I've just driven through that with pace notes. And he said, you're only, well, I think it was his co-driver said, I was 3 minutes behind him at the end of, I don't know, 90 kilometres. And he said, you know, George, your pace, if you were entered in the rally, he said, you'd definitely be top five here. It just made it worse for me, honestly. Don't tell me that. Don't make it worse.
You don't need to know that, do you? You don't need to know
don't
that.
Need to, don't need to know that. And I was driving without pace notes. But of course, I was used to, I did the Swedish rally, Thousand Lakes rally, but rallies in Belgium to learn pace notes. But all my rallying in UK, it was always on blind stages. So, you know, you've got that instinct is not bad. I will confess to being lucky a couple of times. And, you know, you'd be lying if you said you weren't.
Don't tell the world that, honestly.
we got lucky a few times. A few times you misread a water splash and... you know, a drift. They're called drifts, dry riverbeds, or what they call drifts, or just washaways. The washaways could be deadly. The drifts could be equally as bad, actually. Sometimes they're concrete. In the middle of a gravel road, and someone's made a concrete plinth through a riverbed with quite sharp edges, and it's maybe only about 20 feet across. If you hit that at 70 miles an hour, you'd not be 45 degrees down into the river and 45 degrees out, you could go right across and land in that. It'd be like landing into a concrete wall face. So you could. It was quite dangerous. But we drove the whole route that year, and it was just amazing. And we were all up El Deret. We went into the Cheringanis, across to Maralel, you know, around Lake Baringo. We did all that. Oh, just amazing. We didn't come back through the Cheringanis. It's a very twisty forested area. It's full rainforest up on the Aberdares, on the east side of the Aberdare Hills, and that's rainforest. But you can't get a helicopter in to film, so there was no point in doing that section. Nah. So that was the bit that we missed that year. It was a shorter section, but we did all round Nanyuki up towards Maralel. Just amazing. And of course down to the south.
It sounds stunning. You've painted that beautifully.
I have driven Safari Rally route in a Group A rally car, albeit just a recce test car, so it wasn't a full spec engine. We were probably about 40 horsepower down, because the car would only pull 220 on the gravel. That's all it would pull, and the full rally cars would do 230 at that time. They were geared a little bit higher, so it wasn't full spec, but it was still pretty amazing.
As an alternative, you still take it, don't you? It's not quite there, but it's a close second to doing.
It was a very close second, better than you could ever have wished for. And I always appreciate that that Uwe Andersen allowed me to do it, but he did get me to phone me before I went. He said, George, he said, this is only a photo shoot. You know that? I said, I know that, Uwe. I said, but you know, we're driving on a route for a photo shoot. He said, you know, anything can happen. He said, George, he said, that's one of my recce cars. It will not be crashed. So there was no pressure. the boss on the phone telling you, I want you to drive my rally car. I want you to make a good photo shoot. Don't crash it. There's no excuse. Don't crash it. Categorically, don't crash it. So, I mean, in a strange sort of way, I've had the same pressure as a lot of the top drivers. That's unfair of me to claim that, actually. I apologise to everyone for even claiming such a thing, but it felt like that at the time.
So, that's perfect. Yeah. That is perfect. Unfortunately, as great as that is, I think we do have to bring this to a close, because we're over an hour, and George, it's closing up to 11 p.m. your time, so you'll need to get yourself well rested for the rally week ahead.
I'm basically here on holiday this year. Luke, 100% basically on holiday. We've done the little bit of freight that we had to do has been done. I've got a tiny little bit to do tomorrow up at Naivasha, and we are going to go up to Lake Baringo, which is as good as it might sound it is. So you're just slightly above the equator. The equator's just above Nakuru, and then it's about another 60, 70, maybe 80 kilometres up to Lake Baringo. We used to stay in the Lake Baringo Lodge, which is smack in the middle, right opposite Kokoway Island, I think it's called. And so it's easy to see where it was. And I say that because the lake level, Lake Baringo, is fed by springs. There are rivers come into it, but it doesn't rain much up there. You're just on the just below the scrub desert. But it's spring fed, and it's a freshwater lake. And the level has risen, so I think it's risen about like 40, 50 feet. And it rose during a drought period, not a wet period. Nobody knows why. But the lake level historically, as much as the history is available, has been known to go up and down. Where we're going, Lake Naivasha, if you look at where Naivasha is itself, is above the lake level, the town, and there's all sea cliffs, you would call them, where the lake Naivasha historically, on the historic records, Lake Naivasha used to go all the way up to Nakuru, Lake Nakuru. So, I mean, that used to be an 80, 90 kilometre long lake. And it's now shrunk down to the size it is. And the level has, the last 5 years, again, the level of that came up extraordinarily high and covered a whole load of farms. And again, not because of any rain, apparently. So it's very, very interesting what nature does to us.
There you go.
So you can see.
It sounds like a more interesting day than what I've got planned. As much as I love my job at Dirtfish, that does sound...
Yeah.
A little bit more beautiful, a little bit more romantic, a little bit more sort of adventurous. So you may be incredibly jealous now.
Good. Are you working at the weekend, or are you having a quiet one?
This weekend I am meant to be off when this podcast comes out, but you never, with this job, you're never truly off, are you? The rally world keeps turning.
So there's no events this weekend for you specifically. Well, I'm going out to Recce the Route on Saturday and Sunday, possibly Monday and Tuesday as well. Little bits of it, because I just like to see the whole route so that I can talk authoritatively and with inside knowledge when we're talking about the event and feeding back and hopefully making a nice show for everybody.
Well, there
I'm
you
quite
go.
Excited if, about it, yeah.
If you would like to see the fruits of George's labour, you know where to go throughout next week. Dirtfish.com is the place to be. The YouTube channel will have all of the videos, previews, analysis and day reviews. Of course, Dirtfish Live Centre when the rally is underway for literally everything behind the scenes to what is going on, up-to-date information and all of the things that our wonderful team is getting up to on the ground. And of course, there'll be Spin the Rally Pod to get yourself in the mood for the rally as well. George, from all the rally fans listening, thank you so much for your stories and your time. We have to do this again. We threaten to do lots of sort of episodes like this with George and never quite get around to it. We've committed to this one, but I think we have to do more, mate.
Well, I'm loving every minute of it. I apologise for people if I've rambled on too long about different things, but I feel like I've only scratched the surface, Luke. Can we do one every day for the next week? I think I've got the content if we don't bore the crap out of everybody.
I don't even doubt that for a second. But for now, thank you, George, and thank you very much to you for listening.